We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boscovich.
An excerpt from Racist with a Yeti, alt-right podcasting from 2014 to 2020. The Pause Button had a notoriously troubled production. Borzoi Boscovich forced his crew to meticulously research obscure topics for the episodes, leading to three injuries. The show's original co-host, Titus Flavius, got tummy sick halfway through production, so Borzoi hired J.O. Del Rey, a podcaster with whom he had previously clashed violently with in the past, on the production of Event Horizon. Their second partnership fared no better, and a commenter even offered to kill J.O. Borzoi reluctantly declined. This is The Pause Button. I am your host, Borzoi. With me this week, I have J.O. as usual.
Hey, I'm glad to be back, since I have not spoken to you in a week. It has been 7 days since I last talked to Borzoi.
And with me as well, I have a very special guest. I have Zero Schizo, good friend of the show, longtime contributor to The People's Square. How you doing, Zero?
Hey, Greg. Hey, gang. How you doing? All great over here. Last news about my country was today we had a soccer football match, the finals, the America Cup, it's called. And we were against Brazil, and we lost against Brazil.
Ah.
GG.
Yes, for people who aren't aware, Zero Schizo is a Peruvian, so one of the reasons why I wanted to have him on for this. But we can also, you have a show of your own, which I've actually been on before, and if you're a subscriber to my RSS feed, you heard that episode that I did on Zero's show. What show is that again?
The Minority Report at the Revolutionary Conservative.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead and check that out. You get a much, like, I've always actually, there used to be that show Beyond the Wall. I've always enjoyed going on, like, non-American shows just to get, like, a different perspective. And this is, I'm looking forward to hearing your perspective on this movie. So this week we're talking about Fitzcarraldo, the Werner Herzog movie, which my first one doing for this show. But the Werner Herzog movie, where the story about the production is actually often more interesting than the movie itself. But I actually quite enjoyed this movie, but J.O., as is customary, first take.
Decent movie. Klaus Kinski is a horrible actor. Just terrible. I was going to save this take, but no, I'll take it from the top. Who does he sound like when he's talking? It's Tommy Wiseau in 1985. I don't know who told this guy he's like an actor for a major budget film by an intelligent director who apparently used this guy several times and made a documentary about him called My Best Friend. Maybe that's what it was, just some kind of nepotism.
Well, no, that was partially ironic, that title, because Herzog and Kinski had a notoriously tumultuous friendship. Like, again, like, that opening bit that I did was cribbed from a description of this movie where it had a notorious, like, one of the extras, a Peruvian Indian chief offered to kill Klaus Kinski on Herzog's behalf, and Herzog reluctantly declined.
Too bad.
Zero, what were your initial thoughts on this movie?
It did remind me a little bit of this movie, The Mission. Have you ever watched that?
I haven't. Is that an American film or some other production?
Yeah, the actor, I believe it's Keanu Reeves, and he's it's a movie about the Franciscan mission to No, the Jesuit mission. Yeah, the Jesuit mission in Paraguay. And that's actually what Dr. E. Michael Jones is always talking about, you know, when the, about the Guaranis in Paraguay. That's he's basically talking about that movie. Well, I did like it because it did reflect a lot of the environment of that time, I would say. Because, for example, we'll go back to that maybe later during down the conversation, because a lot of the characters are actually well represented, because he is this guy Klaus Kinski. He's actually representing really well the archetype of the Peruvian entrepreneur from that time.
Yeah, he's the Peruvian robber baron. Rubber baron. Rubber baron.
Mm-hmm.
Which I wasn't aware that Peru was like had been like a big rubber a location for. I actually didn't even know until I saw this movie how you get rubber. I was not aware of this.
And also that's another thing that Brazil actually got better to do than us. It's not just in football, but in the rubber production that our main competitor was Brazil, and Brazil won this thing. Also to notice that inside Brazil, you already had, by that time, you already had established many merchant routes, and many bankers started to invest inside of Brazil. Brazil became a colony of bankers during that time period, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, in the town where this is first set, like Iquitos, like there, you actually even have, you have the rubber barons, we go to the brothel there, and it's also got like a booming community of Europeans and actually Sephardic Jewish immigrants in that city as well. Like it's just a very mixed multicultural city, like in the middle of like, you know, just like the, like from the European perspective, just in the middle of nowhere, basically.
that's what I was getting at, talking about Brazil and talking about Iquitos in this sense, because during that time period, I have been reading a book called Being Jewish in Peru. It's all Jews, you know, talking about what was life for the first Jewish settlers. And they do have a chapter talking about this, not specifically the rubber baron type of stuff, but they do talk about when they did set the city of Iquitos. And it was basically two waves of Jewish immigration. The first wave, they did settle some stuff, but they got lost. In during the movie, they talk to you about, you know, this Amazon jungle is really dubious. It's really strange because unforgiving because it always presents you with mirages, illusions, and all this type of stuff. And this is what happened to the first Jewish migrants. They just disappeared. Like nobody knew. The Jews themselves, nobody.
The Indians threw them out. Peru was 110. There's still some dude in a loincloth with a bone through his nose sitting in the middle of that jungle somewhere muttering to himself like, pinche judío.
Pinche judío, lo voy a hacer jabón.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a few Jewish shrunken heads. Actually, no.
But the nose is still all huge.
Although,
side box. I'm actually a little interested now. I hadn't really given this much thought, but throughout Spanish imperialism, I'd like to know the Sephardic role in.
They had a huge role in colonization in the New World. That's why AOC, like when she was, I mean, like obviously she was kind of sucking up to her donors, but like she was like going off of like hit known like kind of like. Going off of historical information of the large role that the Sephardic Jews played in the colonization of the New World, it was a way to get them out of Spain, basically, because they had just finished up like the Reconquista, and there was always the issue of like having people who were crypto Jews, basically, and this was frankly a way to get rid of these people.
Yeah. The conversos.
Yeah,
I remember. By the way, yes, talking about that, it is well known, well established that Jews like big water bodies, like rivers, the seas, ports, all this type of stuff. And throughout history, they have always established themselves nearby rivers, but they did the Amazon jungle did backfire on them. And that's part one of the first Jewish migration. The second Jewish migration towards these parts, towards Iquitos and all these type of places, were from actually Turkish Jews. And they went there and they did settle in Iquitos, and they did build, if I recall correctly, they did build a specific district not so far away from Iquitos, but even then, these guys did started to mix with other peoples, and as you see, there are even black people over there.
Yeah,
they just disappeared. They just vanished because all of the other cultures and tribal aspects were much more dominant than the Jewish aspect, which is overwhelmingly merchant. Because what are you going to trade if you cannot dominate that dubious and unforgiving river?
Yeah. Well, I feel really bad for them. Do we want to set this up a little bit?
Yeah, as I said, let's talk about now. Let's talk, we're going to be mixing a lot of, and this is why I wanted to have Zero Schizo on, because he can give us a lot more context for what's going, like some of the, like the time periods and like in this movie. Let's talk about the movie itself so we don't get too far off track like these guys, like the guys in the movie did. So basically, this is a movie that's about, you know, dreaming your dream no matter how ostentatious it is and no matter how much it fails and blows up in your face, basically. So you have Brian Sweeney Fitzgerald, whom they all call Fitzcarraldo because they can't say Fitzgerald, who is actually based off of a rubber baron named Carlos Fitzcarraldo. Not the same guy. They're actually there's actually not a lot of similarities between the two other than this general idea of moving a boat over land, and that the original way was actually done differently. But he's this opera lover who it's his dream to basically build an opera house in Iquitos, which is this, at the time, it's just this backwater town on the river. It's, you know, it's get, like they're slowly like they growing it with immigrants, but it's like, it's whatever. It's just backwater town. He wants to build an opera house there so he can bring the great Robert Caruso, one of the greatest opera singers of all time, to come in and sing there and like make this into a thing. This is his dream more than anything else. And you can tell he's committed to this stuff because the opening scene is him, like their motor went down and he rode all the way to whatever city it was. Like they rode all the way to where the opera house was, blooding his hands along the way just so he could get a glimpse of Robert Caruso singing a little bit, and he catches the end of it. So then he gets this idea into his head that if he can capture these rubber trees that nobody is like bothering with because you can't get up the river due to the rapids, then he can make a fortune that's going to allow him to build that opera house. Because his previous venture already failed. He tried to do a Trans-Andean railway, an utter failure, an absolute disaster. They don't really cover what exactly happened, but it just was an absolute disaster. Basically, it was like he dreamed too big and was too foolish to see that it was not feasible. While going along this theme, they go down the other river, another tributary of the Amazon, which it comes to a point where there's only a 1 mile separation between the two rivers, so they can bypass the rapids. And he decides, like, we're going to just pull this damn ship over to the other side of the river and get the rubber trees over there. And what transpires is the adventure and all the problems that come with that. And this is where like this movie's extremely famous, because Werner Herzog, a guy who, like, two things about his movies that are kind of like consistent. It's often about man versus nature, and it's also about like trying to create a cinematic experience the like of which you've never seen by making it as realistic as possible, to the point that he actually pulled that boat over the mountain.
Yeah, which is incredible.
Yeah.
A 320-pound boat. They used pulleys to manually drag this thing over the mountain, which then, so this is the pause button, and we're going to talk about, you know, reality is more real than your mom or whatever. But it became, sort of the same white whale for Herzog that it was for the character, that it was for Fitzcarraldo to do this massive undertaking that no one had ever done before.
Yeah, and Herzog admits like he did it just so he could they could say like it was done, that he was that it could be done. Like it was like one of those things, you know, why does a man climb a mountain? Because it's there. Like there was that was what that was for Herzog, and he like you have to kind of admire.
And then no one can call his plot unrealistic either.
Yeah.
Right? Like yeah, if you did that with CGI, someone could be like, oh, you could never get a boat over a mountain in the Andes.
Yeah, the real Fitzcarraldo, he broke his boat down piece by piece, and they carried it across the cross.
It was less than a tenth the size of this boat.
Yeah,
the real Fitzcarraldo's boat was 30 tons. This one was 320.
Yeah, it's I forgot what I was going. I forgot where I was kind of going with this, but basically, it's the ultimate art through adversity. Oh, now I remember where I was going with this, because like this also speaks to Herzog's tenacity. This is what a true artist is, and why we're getting so much like, and we're getting fewer and fewer of guys like this, like because this movie took 4 years to make. He even lost his original actor Jason Robards through production, and he now when he brought on Klaus Kinski, a guy he'd already clashed with before, they had to reshoot the entire movie because they couldn't, like, for continuity reasons, there was no way to like reuse any of the old footage because the movie is so heavily focused on Fitzcarraldo. He's basically in almost all the shots in one way or another. Like, there's no way for them to kind of try to piece it together. They had to redo this entire movie, and that was without getting into all the other problems of the boat, of having to get that across the land, as well as like having to deal with the local Indians, they hired them for that. And then, like the madness that you're seeing in this jungle, they were going through that as well. Like Klaus Kinski is a guy, I think it's confirmed he had schizophrenia. He was a guy who was already crazy. This movie made him crazier because of their experience in the jungle and what it did to their minds.
Yeah.
By the way,
a lot of people also were
you?
Go ahead.
Yeah. But were you saying that, what's the name of the director?
Herzog. Herzog.
Yeah, did you say, are you implying that Herzog had a Faustian spirit? That is white, no question.
He had what?
Faustian spirit, yeah.
Oh, actually. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, he did.
But a lot of people were hurt in the making of this. And what's funny is, you know, they had this other actor cast as Fitzcarraldo in the beginning, 6 weeks in. He has to drop out. They have to reshoot all of it. But what's funny is they had to recast another role, too, because the actor in this other role wasn't going to be able to stay for the duration of filming, given that they had to start over. And that was it Keith Richards or Mick Jagger?
Mick Jagger.
Yeah. Mick Jagger was playing Fitzcarraldo's assistant, but they had to replace him, too, because the film wasn't going to wrap until before he had to go on tour.
Yeah, it's, and then of course like you had just like Kinski's insanity, like him like freaking out over food and the like, and like all this exasperated by the actual conditions they're shooting in,
and then the Indians getting so fed up with them that they burnt the fucking set down.
Yeah, by the way, do you want me to go deep, a little bit deeper on the Mick Jagger issue?
On the what?
The Mick Jagger issue.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Apparently, Mick Jagger, when came here to take a taste of cocaine, of Peruvian cocaine, because he heard that it was the best. Yeah. So he.
Brazil might have beat you guys at rubber, but God damn it, they're not gonna beat you in cocaine.
Yeah. So he went to the Amazon jungle where it was the best place to get, of course, Iquitos as a Jewish port. Well, it of course had drug trafficking and all this type of stuff during that time period that the film was being made. So it was a perfect fit for him, and he also got a Peruvian girlfriend called Monique Pardo, and she's still around. She's a funny person, but in any case, they became a couple, and they were like basically living in Iquitos and living in during the Amazon jungle, and it was 4 months, and then Mick Jagger went to tour, and then he came back, I believe that was maybe a year after that, and so he was unable to reprise his role, and so he just decided to stay over there in the Amazon jungle and try cocaine and fuck Monique Pardo. That's the extent. That's the extent of that.
That's Mick Jagger. That sounds like Mick Jagger, really.
Yeah.
He was starting up
drug tourism.
So I guess we get getting into kind of like the movie itself here. So I gave kind of the synopsis on this. Where do you guys kind of want to go with this? Because I know we're kind of mixing together the movie itself and the production of the movie, and it's kind of hard not to because the two things paralleled each other. Like a lot, like well, one was feeding into the other.
This movie, as I chimed to Borzoi while watching it, is this is Ayn Rand has just seen Apocalypse Now and wants to make her own movie. You've got this bumbling man possessed who has this sort of silly life's dream to bring opera into the jungle. And that's very much like the Man Against Nature thing. Like, what is more sort of, you know, high culture, high society than opera? And they want to put it in the starkest sort of place that it doesn't belong. And he wants to put it in this sort of little shipping town or whatever, but that requires him to go even more backwoods, right? Like, it's sort of, I wouldn't say it's ham-fisted, but it's very obvious the dichotomy they're trying to make about civilizing the wild, right? Yeah. Bringing opera to the Amazon. How does it get more extreme?
This is the Anprin movie, because the primitive nature wins. So,
yeah, and but, kind of the way that the plot wraps up is, so he finally gets his boat down to this isthmus, and him and his guys achieve this Herculean task, even after having been, you know, attacked, mutinied, abandoned. They go through this sort of odyssey of their own, pull off this Sisyphean feat of getting this boat up over the thing, and they are helped by the Indians because the Indians have some sort of prophecy about a white god that will take them to some kind of promised land. And he's dressed all in white, and here he comes on this steamboat. So, like good pilgrims or whatever, they help him get his boat over the mountain. But the whole reason to take it over the mountain was to avoid these rapids on the river that's on the other side of the mountain. Well, once they get the boat over to the other side, they've still got it tied to the land. And in the middle of the night, the Indian chief cuts the boat loose because he's like, well, you circumnavigated the rapids. Now the gods are going to get mad. So you have to ride out the rapids, right?
Yeah, you transgressed against nature.
Right. They actually do make it down the rapids. And again, to go back to the production thing, a ton of people were hurt in the filming of that scene. But the steamboat does make it down past these rapids, and he kind of has to just go home a failure now because they put in all this work and then essentially got reset to zero. He goes back. He's going to sell the boat back to the sort of Monopoly Man Jewy character that he bought it from.
Yeah, and the rubber Baron.
Yeah, the Rubber Baron. Yeah. But he still
has... Yeah, actually, that's the archetype of a Peruvian conservative.
Okay.
Mm. Well, go ahead, finish your... We'll get to that in a second. Go ahead and finish your point,
Jim. And it sort of ends with Fitzcarraldo takes what money he does have left and sends his riverboat captain, his steamboat captain, to the city to go pick up this opera company and have them perform on the boat coming up the coastline. So he does ultimately get this performance, even though he doesn't get rich and build an opera house. It's sort of like good enough for him, even though he's going to be starting from zero again.
I found that actually kind of particularly inspiring. It's just that even in the end, like, he's still going to pursue his dream no matter what it takes. Like, I kind of like, I love stories like that where it's just absolute, like, everything is going against you. You just cannot win. But in the end, you still manage to, scrape something together. I find stories of failure to be some of my favorite stories, probably because I relate to them on some kind of deep psychological level.
No, you just liked this movie because they used Pagliacci. Sad clown.
That is me. Okay, so I don't know. Like, that's the thing about this movie that I find, like, that's like, to me, like, the most, like, pertinent topics to kind of talk about with this, just like within the context of the movie itself, is that theme of failure and man versus nature. I've seen, like, Roger Ebert describe this movie as imperfect but transcendent, and that's something I can probably agree with in kind of assessing this movie. It's a technical kind of feat in and of itself. It's actually really great to watch because, like, I mean, that's Herzog has always been an extremely technical filmmaker, and it's his ability to really kind of convey that to you on screen, like the absolute realism of it, that makes his movies very interesting to watch. And so, and the other theme obviously being man versus nature, which is endemic to a lot of his films. The only other thing I would add to that would be like the Peruvian stuff as well.
I agree, but I was just pulled out of my suspension of disbelief so many times by the awful performance that Kinski gave, or at least that I feel he gave. It kept sort of jarring me back to reality. I think that the man versus nature thing is especially interesting in the colonial context. I really like colonial depictions in films. I seriously romanticize British colonialism in particular. You know, if I could go back any time in history, I think I'd want to be back and forth between Victorian Kenya and London, you know. When you're getting the opportunities that these guys are getting to go be the adventurous, self-made man, putting your life on the line, are you going to end up with dysentery? Are you going to end up with malaria? Are you going to end up dead in the jungle with your head shrunken on a stick? Or are you going to become a millionaire?
Yeah. I think it's a great point. Like, if you want to kind of jump in here, Zero, like, because, like, since we're talking about colonialism, that's a huge part of this movie. I know you had said that basically these rubber barons are the portrait of a Peruvian conservative. Like, kind of your thoughts on this and in relation to Peruvian history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Because what you have seen, this type of douchebag that is always going to tell you that you shouldn't do this, and he's just, you know, rubbing in into no pun intended, and rubbing in that into your face, your failure, rubbing your failure into your face, and always trying to bring you down, break up your spirit. Yeah, that's actually the archetype of a Peruvian conservative, because that is what they do, because they want to remain in power. They don't want to be challenged. They don't want to get their ideas or their monopoly challenged. And therefore, you have this type of snarky type of attitude sometimes. But overall, an overall douchebag, because he has money, he has the connections, the power, and all this type of stuff. That is essentially the how a Peruvian conservative is. And I mean, true conservatives that are at parliament. I'm not talking about your average normicon on the streets. No, I'm talking about people that do wield power. They are like that, and they are conservatives.
Yeah, and you see that in this movie, like with the way that they treat Fitzcarraldo. Like, he's a novelty. He's like the butt of their jokes, basically. One of them just like what you can like. One of them is funds him because he doesn't believe that this is going to ever be successful, and he's like, this is just a hobby for him to like watch this guy, you know, like struggle so hard and then fail so hard, and like, you know, being so magnanimous to pay him for his troubles on that. They even like, but they're when the rubber barons are all together, they make fun of him for the his idea of the Trans-Andean Railway as well. So that, yeah, I can now see like what you're saying with like this is typical of that class of people in your country, which I guess, so that would be like a holdover from those colonial days then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, essentially That's what they have done across our history. But these people are in reality pussies, because they don't, like I told you, they don't want to be challenged. They don't want to struggle. They don't want to feel the thrill of the fight itself. That they don't want them. They just want to do their own thing, but they are douchebags at the heart, and that's what they have done across history. Because another point, talking about the Peruvian robber baron stuff, is that this guy didn't. He had the monopoly of it, but he didn't understand that he was going to be challenged later by the Brazilians, because that guy from Brazil. That guy that was expelled from Brazil, another robber baron, had a similar situation, and this other Brazilian dude managed to get the word out to Brazil, and Brazil, you know, they won the battle of this type of competition, because these douchebags did not understand that they would have to make the production in different ways in order to make it more. Not only much more profitable, but much more efficient. And that's what the Brazilians did. And that's why our conservatives across history have always been defeated by other powers, whether it be regional powers or international powers. And that's the history of my country, basically.
Mm. This is almost off topic, but not entirely. Isn't there also a huge Japanese population in Peru?
Oh, yeah.
somewhat, not. It's not that huge, because it always gets censored as if you know, we have Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans, but they are all put together.
Yeah, it's like 4% of the population when you count them all together, from what I understand.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that they started coming a long time ago, though.
It's notable, and like Schizo can correct me if I'm wrong. What's notable about it is because a lot of Japanese, in their diaspora, a lot of them did end up in Peru and Brazil. But like when you look at that relative to the population, it's not as huge as it would seem. But because they became like a significant part of those cultures, especially in Peru, and it's like more known in Peru because a lot of Peruvian and Brazilian Japanese came back to the homeland at one point to be guest workers. But Peru is just notable because everyone knows about Alberto Fujimori, who was the president of Brazil, and that Brazil, Peru, and has his own kind of little political following, which I think you described to me, Schizo, before. They're kind of almost neoconservative, I think, or some
neoliberal.
That's what it was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I actually briefly. This was a long time ago now, but I briefly dated a very wealthy Peruvian girl, and she said that her high school in Peru, like the private school that she went to, was like a third Japanese.
Yeah, it really depends, because there are schools where Japanese people go. I know a couple of them. And there are other places, like, for example, it really depends on the district, I would say, because okay. most of the diaspora are in two districts. One is called Jesus Maria, and the other part of the diaspora is in, I would say, in Pueblo Libre. Yeah. It's called Freetown, you know, if you translate that. And those two districts do have really high paid schools, private schools, really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the diaspora of the Japanese are there. So it's not a coincidence, and it's not really that difficult to see that. But for example, if you go to other districts like San Borja, for example, they have a lot of Palestinian population over there, Palestinian and some Syrians here and there, but overwhelmingly Palestinian. And they also have schools. They have a club even. It's called the Palestinian Arab Club. And I know different people that are a part of that, and they are involved in BDS and all this type of stuff. So I would say it's much more of a district situation. Of course, it's the same city, but it would be like counties. In your case scenario, so it really depends on the county where you are located at that specific time.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's see here what we can.
Yeah, I just took us totally off track.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, with the kind of the colonial. Oh, I mean, I do have one note on this Peruvian colonialism, because you actually, like, one of the interesting things I found about this is, like, one of the things that happens, like, when you have colonialism and the caste system that the Latin American countries had, is that you have these natives who, like, a lot of them end up being like mestizos themselves, from what I understand. Peru, like, the largest population is mestizo, and then I think the next largest is probably the Indians, and then you have your European descent and Asian descent and all the other groups, but mm-hmm. You have these natives who, you know, in history they converted and they become educated, and they might be mestizos themselves, and what they do is that they consider themselves Peruvian, and then, you know, like, I'm not an Indian, like, an Indian is somebody who can't read
and doesn't know how to wash their clothes.
Yeah, like, and I mean, uh-huh. that's an interesting thing, like, that really kind of, like, stood out in this movie. Now, of course, the movie doesn't linger on it, but for American audiences, especially people who aren't, like, educated in this kind of stuff and understand how the caste system worked, like, that can probably be pretty jarring. But I mean, like, as somebody who's been interested in that stuff, that was like a nice little Easter egg that I enjoyed.
Yeah, I would say it's much more of a social question rather than a racial question in this sense. I mean, post-colonial time. Do you want to know how a lot of Chinese and Japanese and even some Vietnamese ended up in my country?
Yeah.
Sure, why not? I mean, like, this is going to be an episode that's a little bit all over the place, but that's what the pause button's all about.
Yeah. Okay. What happened was that during La Era del Caucho, as it's called, or the Caucho era.
Oh, like the cowboy, the Spanish cowboys.
Yeah, the robber era.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happened was this was our second boom. Our first boom was the era of guano. Guano is actually fertilizer. You know, it's
that shit.
Yeah, it's literally shit. Yeah, it's literally shit, and it was formed in the coast of my country by I believe seagulls. It is. Shit from seagulls plus some nutrients. I think it's from
bats, right?
No.
There's bat guano, but like guano, like what he, like I understand what Schizo is talking about, like, because guano is like a very particular thing. Like, it's like for farmers, they use something from some kind of bird. The Guane cormorant is like what I'm seeing pull up when I'm looking at this. But like we also use the term guano for bat shit as well.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. One is essentially shit. Bird shit, most accurately. But yes, it's a very specific type of shit that is used for as fertilizer, and it was big in during the, I believe, the 19th century or 18th century. Maybe during the late 80s and early
19th century, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, during that time gap, and that was started to be exported to Europe and to North America. So that's one of the that was our first boom. And in order to get all this shit on boats and all this type of stuff, a lot of people started to, you know, a lot of these barons, a lot of these guys in the industry started to import people from Japan, people from China, and they were promising a lot of stuff, but they were when they came here, they basically become slaves. Mm-hmm. They were in a much worse situation than Indios, and literally.
Hey, we did that in our country too.
Yep.
A bunch of Chinese people over and pretty much enslaved them to build railroads.
Well, one thing they would do is, like, because this is the time of the Manchu dynasty, or like when the Manchus were in power in China, and they made all males wear what they called the Q hairstyle. That's that long, where they shaved your head and you had the long ponytail. Like, you could not cut that on pain of death, basically. And that's one thing they would do is, like, they would, like, when they came here, they would basically forcibly cut these guys' hairstyle, so there was no chance for them ever returning to their country.
That's interesting. And now we have them making podcasts.
Yeah.
But anyways, continuing with that, they were called, there was a particular term with this Chinese, overwhelmingly Chinese, but also Japanese and Vietnamese and Filipinos even. They were called coolies.
We had coolies. The same word, buddy. Coolies. Coolie labor.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. But the difference is that Americans did actually send them back to their country. Some of them, but over here that did not happen because nobody wanted to take them back to the country. So they just remained here and they got assimilated. It, of course, it was a little bit of an Easter egg. But during our fascist party that popped up later, which is called the Revolutionary Union Party, they targeted them. You know, as the main source of problem. Instead of pointing out at Jews, they started pointing out at the Chinese. So it was weird and it was funny. But after that, they got assimilated because, you know, otherwise they will always were going to be targeted as foreigners.
I was just looking at some of the stuff. I didn't realize that, like, where you guys are harvesting, they call it the guano pits of Peru, which just sounds so horrifying.
Yeah,
the literal shit mines.
Yeah, and this, of course, and that was the first era, and the second era was with the rubber stuff.
Yeah,
and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other thing I guess, like, since we're kind of talking on these ones, is the one of the parts I was amused by in this movie was. Because like it plays into like the Quetzalcoatl thing of like you know Europeans, like how strange they seemed to the natives when they came here, and they played into all their the religions and stories about like say Quetzalcoatl and the like, and the Indians here, like you seem like it seems like it's gonna play out the exact same way, and they're informed like we know you're not the god. We're well aware of that fact.
Yeah, we know you're not God, but you kind of look like him, so we'll help out.
Yeah. Well, this is like, and that's one of those things that like has always kind of been a problem of colonialism, is that because you know people like kind of write off the Indians as being really stupid. Like there's been often instances of where people have underestimated their much more low cunning, like, you know, getting one up on you, like with headhunting, for instance, because like that became actually something of interest to people. It's like, this is really weird and creepy. I must have this. And so there was an entire industry that was started to, like, that they created for these Indians for headhunters. Now people were killed and they did have their heads shrunken for purposes of selling, but they've discovered through kind of like testing the various ones that are in museums, like something like 80% of them are probably fake. Like this is like they end up learning how to fake this stuff and duping the Europeans who wanted these macabre basically examples of primitive humanity. And like people have a lower cunning to them than people often gave them credit for, which plays into this movie where basically like they don't question like why these people are helping them, and it ends up getting them in the end.
Yeah. It's almost like the you can go to certain parts of Africa and like you're out in the cut, you're out in the middle of nowhere. And you're going to do sort of a tourism and you're going to go out there and see this tribal dance, and they come out there and do their tribal dance. And then they all get on a bus that takes them back to the parking lot. They get in their cars and drive home.
Yeah. people are so like fascinated by this idea of like the uncontacted tribe. Mm-hmm. You know, like you have, like, and there's still some in the Amazon. Then you have that famous one on the Sindhalese that's you know off the shore of India who kill anybody that comes near them.
Yeah,
like people are very fascinated by that because like we're looking for some kind of glimpse of primitive humanities because
well, it's
of
authentic,
this,
right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like it seems authentic. Yeah. It seems foreign. It seems like this is how we are at our base nature. What people like often don't realize is because like the moment that first contact was made with tribes, like it was over. Like everything, like at that point, everything changes, and people can learn how to play a part for you. So oftentimes, throughout all kinds of colonial history, while obviously these people get dominated, like they also know kind of like how, they learn from observing how to like play, you know, play their colonists. you know, in the long run, doesn't work out for them. They can figure out how to make their own little tidy profits and play a part for these people playing to fantasies.
Yeah, and I want to go back to to go deeper into that topic about the uncontacted tribes. There are like two or three in my country, and you know why is that? That's exactly because of the Gaucho era, the robber era. Because a lot of you had a lot of barons, not only Fitzcarraldo, but they were popping up more and more, and you know you had then Jews popping up, and you know slavery. They were mistreated. Some of them were started to get hunted, just in order to have them as labor slave men, and of course most of them decided to retreat into the deep jungle, and they became this. Uncontacted tribes, but they are not uncontacted. We have contacted them via these people, and they do not have, they do not want to have to do with any type of stuff that we are doing. And in my political movement, we call them proto-Peruvians because they have had some type of connection during history with other Peruvians, and they know that something's going on around them, but they don't want to be a part of it yet. So for us, it's more of trying to do stuff around them, and if we are lucky, they might want to rejoin our society and our civilization. Of course, we are not going to do like, and this is another important topic, like for example the it was the priests. Yeah, the priests that we're talking about, you know, we're civilized, these people, it's like, no, we like them to remain as they do, but if they see any benefit in learning stuff that they want to ask us, you know, we don't have any issue with that, because across history, these people have been important. For example, during the war, the uprising of communists that we had during the 80s and the 90s, a lot of these communists started to retreat back into the jungle, and these tribes took them out of the picture. And we literally bow and arrows, and you know, wood made traps and all these types of stuff. This is why these people are important, because there are American bases across the Amazon jungle. So we are going to need them. We are definitely going to need them. We're going to need their knowledge, just like the Lebanese did with Hezbollah during the 80s. You know, sometimes you get lost in the Amazon jungle, and the Amazon jungle, as it's been said across the movie, is unforgiving.
Yeah, when your ideology sucks so bad that you get blown the fuck out by primitive uncontacted tribes,
like the Taliban.
If people were straying off the Amazon, have we started too far from this movie? But I mean, that is a theme of this movie, like of the tension between civilization and nature. And I mean, like Herzog basically tells you what the theme of all this is, right? In that opening thing, that only after man has disappeared will God finish his work. Like, and it kind of like really drives home, like this is actually a very Faustian movie in that sense. Fitzcarraldo really is a Faustian character, because he's trying to bring civilization to its height, and he sees that through opera and especially through Wagner, and he wants to bring this into the Amazon. And much like Faustian Man, and as Spengler talks about in The Decline of the West, like ultimately he is going to fail. Like that, you know, the dream of it is just too big and it's more than a man can even bear. Like that's, I had a note on here, like I called this like a meta Wagnerian movie, because like it's kind of like a very Wagnerian theme as well. Let me see. Oh yeah, the film is meta Wagnerian with its tale of heroic tragedy as Fitzcarraldo journeys in vain in order to create an opera house. Because like, I mean, that was Wagner's thing, was opera. So yeah. It's like a meta Wagnerian movie in that respect.
No, I see it. It's obvious to anyone who has, if you have even a passing understanding of opera, to take a look at the soundtrack to this, and they get cheeky with it. Like I said, they use Pagliacci in here for obvious reasons, and you're going to get what do we got? We've got Strauss, Bellini, Puritani, right? So Puritan settlers, whatever. They get a little bit cheeky with it, and I don't know all of these pieces, but like if you only know 5 or 8 pieces of opera, they're in here.
Yeah, and ultimately nature wins in the end. It's that's like the tension as human beings. We like, and that's actually something like that that people. Well, is
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's something that people on Graph Twitter, the hashtag that I started. Like, we're always trying to balance these things. Is how do we find our balance with nature exactly? And that's like that's always been a theme of any kind of anything kind of environmental. There's that famous montage movie about like snapshots of industrialization and nature called Koyaanisqatsi, which means a world out of balance. What were we gonna say, Jo?
Nature wins in this, in as much as a race realist, it would be insofar as you would correctly classify these Indians as fauna.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, they are with their name. Like, I mean, like people might, like, I even balked at that, at calling these people that when I first kind of got into this thing of like calling them fauna. But like, as like, it's not wrong though, because especially like when the, like with people who are more like kind of connected to like just being like a product of nature, basically being a pure product of nature, like that is like a sense of fauna. Like they are a type of fauna in that respect. I mean, like these aren't people who are going to build Berlin. That's not what they're, right. That's just, that's something.
Yeah. I'm not saying that to be like shockingly racist. I mean, if someone takes some comedy from it, then great. But when you are dealing with like straight up jungle tribe people, who have been living this same way for thousands of years without advancing, and you know the examples of the uncontacted tribes that Schizo gave us, these people don't want to participate. They're just a part of the land the same way that deer and birds are.
Yeah. And every case of an uncontacted tribe kind of being against their will forced to join civilization has always destroyed these people. Much like, you know, like, I mean, we have that.
They become suicidal drunks.
Yeah, exactly. Like their bodies weren't designed for this stuff. Like this is, and their lifestyle was not designed for this.
Yeah, that is what I was going to get at, but very quickly, I would say that to me the balance is more of a forward. And that is, and I am not quoting Andrew Yang on that, but I would say that to me the future is archaeofuturism, because these people are archaic. Yeah. They are doing like the things that they have done across history, but we need to learn a lot. We need to not lose this type of stuff when we are dealing with Amazon jungle, or like you guys talked about, for example. Inside Africa, so that is a component that we must not lose to this open society, to this industrial world. But at the same time, we must not need to be technophobics. We just need to find the correct balance.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we need to find the correct balance to use these technologies, but always taking into consideration these archaic elements that we already possess, or we must rediscover. That's to me, that's the way forward. And going back to the other topic about what was it? The contracted tribes,
fauna,
and what else we were talking about?
Oh man,
yeah, these people trying to integrate them. When you bring them into the world?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for example, they have their own order. They have their own logos, their own way of being. You know, just let them be and observe them. Yeah, observe them for what they are and try to pick up some ideas from them. Because always when we look at things that are outside of our realm of understanding is when we start to develop new ideas. That's how I see these type of connections and relationships between uncontacted tribes and us.
Yeah, I can't remember the story specifically, but there were people observing an uncontacted tribe in Brazil who, by observing them, learned some way to clean water of a particular... There was something that just nobody could figure out how to filter or get around. I don't know if it was a parasite or a virus or what have you. But by observing this uncontacted tribe, they learned how to do it. And then the settlers were able to move further inland to where this essentially poison water was. It was now a potable water source.
Mm-hmm. There's a famous story, and I actually really encourage everybody to find the story. It's in I read it in Natural History Mag. I don't know if it's like, who knows if this is even a supposedly like this is a true story. Who knows? Like, it's one of these things. Like, I don't know what the citation and source on this, but it's the story of Shakespeare in the bush, and it basically is this woman, this anthropologist, who's trying to explain to this West African tribe the story of Hamlet, because I got this belief that all human stories are universal, and all you have to do is tweak a couple things about it, and the story will translate to any culture, basically. Hamlet, especially, because, like, it's a story of agonizing over revenge, of having to avenge one's father and the like. And she tries to explain Hamlet to this West African tribe that is living in such a vastly different life from modern humans. And they cannot grasp the story because of the fundamental context that they're living in. Like, the first roadblock she runs into, for instance, is because, like, for people, refresher on Hamlet, Hamlet learns that his father is murdered because his father's ghost comes and speaks to him. Well, these people don't believe in ghosts, and they think that anything like that is witchcraft, and they kill all witches. So, like, if a spirit is telling Hamlet, if a spirit is telling Hamlet that he's been killed, well, that spirit is a product of witchcraft and is therefore a liar. It's not real. So, and she goes through, like, and then it gets to the point where Hamlet is going to kill his uncle Claudius, and they don't get this. It's like, but he's the chief. It doesn't matter who the chief is. Like, you don't kill the chief. And it's just this. They try to, like, present the story as sometimes cultures are just really different, and they, like, our literature, like, you can't really translate literature the exact way. But, like, if this story is real, I mean, like, it's an example of, like, there are people that are living in a way, like, you're just not, you can, like, it does not matter how you explain our civilization to them. It's not, like, part of their nature. They're never going to understand it. And that's something that basically kind of, like, the colonists, you know, like, when they're dealing with these Indians, they try to get them into civilization, but the ones that resist it, they think they can just kind of rule over these people. And what ends up happening, at least in this movie, is that you can't. Like, they have a better understanding of who they are, and they can, with that, because of that, they can get one on you, because they are living close to their nature than many people are living closer to their own.
And in contrast to what you said, because of these Africans that feel everything is witchcraft, over here we have Amerindians that feel that everything has a spirit, because they were saying that there are the spirits of the jungle, there are the spirits of the river. Do you know when they were talking about the, I believe it's the whirlpools or the fast,
the rapids.
Yeah, the rapids. Yeah, they said, "Oh, the spirits of the river are angry, angry at you, and they are not going to let you get away with passing over them." So it's really interesting to see this contrast. I do disagree with the issue of calling European civilization, because to me it's more of an open source type of stuff, because you have these people, while they, you do not consider them a civilization, I do consider them a civilization per se, because to me the idea is multipolarity, not unipolarity. Because if we were talking about having just one way of doing things, then we will be, there wouldn't be any difference between Africans and Europeans, or Afghanistanis, Afghans and Iraqis and all these Middle Easterns with Europeans, because if that was the case, they would integrate with the European civilization. And we are watching that That's not the case. That has not happened, and it won't happen.
Well, it's also a part of biological capability. When I say these people are uncivilized, like, they cannot create nor can they maintain what I call civilization, and that's part of what makes it civilization, is that these sort of lower peoples can't do it.
As I said, I will disagree with that, but just on a different frequency, because what I'm saying is that, for example, we praise too much the material stuff, but these people don't. These people praise the immaterial, the spiritistic, the animistic type of stuff much more than they do with the material stuff. Because, for example, yes, you need computers, you need this type, your cars and all this type of stuff. But these people don't. They do not need this, and they will, for example, they would be able to live just like they do in this environment, in anywhere else, without all of this stuff. And that's what is important that I am trying to make a point about.
Well, I think being content with so little is sort of further evidence to being a lower creature. Like, if you're content to just walk around in your loincloth in the woods all day, I mean, great. I'm glad you're happy out there.
Don't knock until you try it, J.O.
And all of these sort of... one thing to remember about all of these people is that they only exist at the mercy of the civilized. And for a long time, the civilized, you know, didn't even want to give them a place at the table. You know, any of these tribes could be wiped out by 100 armed men or one guy with typhus. They're in a very insecure situation.
Yeah, but that's the issue, you know. Maybe we should just let them be. And, you know, if this is the case, nature will dispose of them. But if this is not the case, they will try to come up with their own particular type of order by themselves. And that's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, I don't think there's any real disagreement here. We're just kind of like more of our just like our personal views on the stuff. Mm-hmm. And on like on the topic of nature, just to kind of be clear as well, because like the problem with I blame like a lot of like what I call iced coffee slut environmentalism for this idea of like nature being like cute and fluffy and the like. And like, no, like when we say like being close to nature, we're not talking about like hippy dippy shit of being like, you know, joining hands and singing Kumbaya and the like.
Reading Marianne Williamson's Twitter.
Yeah. Like, I mean, Herzog actually nails it himself when he's talking about nature. Because, like, this was this is kind of what really got. And this is not the first movie that that Herzog filmed here, but, like, this is, like was kind of his. Fitzgerald was kind of like the movie that helped make Herzog what he is as a filmmaker. And he had this quote about nature, about his more than half year in like in the rainforest, the jungle here. And Herzog says, "Kinski always says nature is full of erotic elements. I don't see it so much as erotic. I see it more as full of obscenity. Nature here is violent, base. I wouldn't see anything erotic here. I would see fornication and asphyxiation and choking and fighting for survival, just rotting away. Of course, there's lots of misery, but it is to say... misery that is all around us. The trees here are in misery. The birds here are in misery. I don't think they sing. They just screech in pain." And that's like that. Yeah. That's the conclusion he came after spending half a year in the deepest parts of Peru. Like, this is the conclusion he came, like, being around, surrounded by pure nature with not a hint of European civilization in sight.
Yeah. I want no part of it. I can tell you that.
Yeah,
we have the tale of the Jews that disappeared. So
their spirits still haunt this jungle. Sometimes, if you listen real, real closely in the middle of the night, you can hear them oy-veying over the Amazon.
It's the one story about a group of Jews who disappeared that you don't hear any stories about, basically. the one place they've been kicked out of that they can't complain about. Because nature took care of that. But
I will say, too, you know, and I've spent some time in a jungle and it was terrible. That's not nature to us.
Yeah.
Right. Like that white people have never belonged in a jungle.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so damn miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this back when I was blue pilled, I'd watch Anthony Bourdain's TV show sometimes, and he goes all over the world, and it was crazy to watch him go into these various jungles around the world. There's one, I think he's in the Congo in particular, and he's just covered in bugs, and the bugs aren't even coming near the natives. Like, our biology is not cut out for this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you see that with the way that many non-European peoples kind of like tend to react to dogs in many respect, because dogs are all over the world, but even like in many places dogs are like a completely different kind of animal to them, and their relationship to that animal is much different. But for us, I mean, like, you know, we had a big part of domesticating the wolf. I mean, like, that the creation of the dog is like a large, like, almost an ironic joke about how we conquered the deep dark fear of the forest, because like that's like for us what our nature was the fear of the forest, especially the dark, you know, the dark wood where the wolves
Wolves out there, bro,
and we conquered them
5 miles away.
We conquered them. And we turned them into babies, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now people dress them up like cowboys and get them $500 haircuts.
It's like, I forgot where I was going. Oh yeah, because like you were bringing up like basically domestication, but like the people, like, we don't really belong in those other parts of the world, and nature kind of like reacts to that in that way, like by trying to violently repulse us in any way possible. I mean, that's what is happening in this movie.
Yeah, remember Vietnam.
Yeah. No, it's like the more foreign the flora and fauna is to European man, like, the more it actually really does try to violently repulse us. I mean, it happened in Afghanistan, it happened in Iraq, it happened in Vietnam.
About the settlers of South Africa and then the Voortrekkers, right? So they hit the Cape, which actually is very similar to Europe in its climate and flora, fauna, what have you. But as you move north, it turns into jungle, it turns into Africa on one side, and then, you know, you go up the other side and it's all desert. We weren't meant for that. And they had this idea that they were going to be able to stretch forever north, because there were white people thriving and farming in Kenya, and we started from the south of this continent, so we can just settle everything from here to Kenya. No, buddy. Like, your white ass has no business in the tropics. They started catching all kinds of crazy diseases. The sort of plants that are agriculture will not grow in that soil. You can't plant corn in the jungle. That's why there's so much of the slash and burn through the Amazon. Like, you have to completely destroy the environment for hundreds of miles around you and then chemically fuck with the soil to get it to, you know, become grazing land or agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what happens. And for example, that has happened when it's land for, not agricultural, but for animal farming.
Mm-hmm. Ranching.
From ranching. That has happened in the Amazon jungle in certain parts of different regions of that, but I would say that at this very moment the most dangerous activity towards the environment would be mining, and of course a lot of Jews are involved in mining, because it's all transnational corporations, and they just predate the environment like no other creature on earth. You know, I was. Do you remember the plagues from I believe it was Moses.
The what from Moses?
The plagues. They weren't plagues. They were actually just Jews planning and doing stuff. That's my take on that.
Yeah, I guess the last comment I have on this, I'm just going to read from this article about it. I mean, like, it's going to be a little bit repetitive because, like, the thing is, Fitzcarraldo is kind of like a straightforward movie. Fitzcarraldo's transcendent message and prominent metaphor is what Herzog calls the helplessness of dreams over the heaviness of reality. Impassioned by his love for Caruso, the music gives Fitzcarraldo his unflinching resolve. Eerily calm scenes feature Kinski's mad character on his boat drifting down the river. The jungle sounds subdued by piercing records that send Caruso reverberating into the untamed world. Fitzcarraldo's fixation leaves him blind to the notion that the beauty of Caruso's voice may not hypnotize the indigenous people as it does him. To give up on moving the boat over the mountain, however, would be the equivalent of giving up on Caruso. And I think we've kind of done to death this topic of, like, trying to introduce our type of civilization to these people. Like, it's not as interesting to them as it is to us. Like, that's kind of like the last theme on this, the one that really resonated with me, was this art through adversity kind of thing. And, you know, the idea of, like, not giving up on your dreams. And this is, at least in the context of America, this is something that people I know actually kind of talk about quite a bit. They focus on a lot, because, like, you have the idea of the American dream. Is it even possible? Is it even real? That kind of thing. And the ability to, I mean, again, going kind of like to the Faustian spirit kind of thing, the ability to, like, just to be able to pursue, like, whatever, like, that impossible dream, other thing, kind of, like, you know, that goes all the way to the days of Don Quixote, the idea of, like, of the impossible dream kind of thing. It's, I mean, that's, like, to me, like, kind of, like, you know, the Peruvian stuff aside, the man versus nature stuff aside, like, that's, like, the biggest draw I took from this movie, of pursuing that relentlessly, as, you know, as insane as it is and as foolish as you might be.
I think I would have liked it better, and I agree with you that that's a great takeaway. I think I would have liked it better if either A, it were, I don't want to say a nobler pursuit, but it just seemed, it was just his performance, but it seemed hokey.
Yeah. Well, but Kinski aside, I mean, Herzog kind of also, like, he called himself the conquistador of the useless, of, like, what's the point of, like, ultimately, what is the point of this movie? Like, it's like, why does a man look at the mountain? Just to see if he can do it. Mm-hmm. Just to see if he can climb it. I mean, and it's, I can see, like, it's why, like,
comes across as so bumbling that I don't get that sort of heroic,
gotcha,
anything to win. And because he doesn't really win, he gets a performance, but he doesn't build an opera house.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's why it resonates with me, because of, like, this theme of failure, which I've always, and then, like, taking what you can get from that. I mean, like, I kind of had to, like, reassess it because of some of its other, like, kind of, like, more paused elements. Like, I always really loved the show The Venture Brothers, because, like, the theme of failure is woven deeply into the show. The creators of the show explicitly said that the theme of their show is failure itself. And I don't know what it says about me that I'm so resonant with this theme, but, like, and also the idea of art through adversity. Like, I just, like, the story of, like, of having to, of doing something like that and being able to put that on film is just really inspiring to me. Like, and I guess because I'm a writer himself who's working on his first novel, and I'm experiencing a lot of roadblocks and a lot of issues along the way, like, being able to just relentlessly pursue that and then try, like, even if you fail, you know, that you made you were able to make the try and cobble something out of that. I don't know. That's just, I guess that's going to be, like, a theme that's going to be kind of, like, going to be more dependent on the individual person, if they find something like that inspiring or not. I guess it spoke to me on a deep level.
I believe it's because of your Mongolian genes, also.
to conquer what cannot be conquered.
Yeah, and later failing.
Yeah. Create one of the greatest empires and have it fall apart within a single generation.
Yeah. But I do take what you were saying about failure in general, because as you see, these barons, these other characters are always making fun of failure. And you shouldn't make fun of failure. You just try to make your failure an opportunity, which is what Fitzcarraldo makes during the movie. He has many failures, but he decides to try something else. And they say, okay, let's see what I have had from my other failures that I have already addressed. And that's also where he, for example, when he was with the Indians, building the ramp, no, to cross from one river to another, he gives the Indians the ice he was talking about. Mm-hmm. He says ice has a lot of properties and all that kind of stuff, and she showed them ice, and she was like, oh, this guy, that's great, and this is new, and okay, let's just continue doing this stuff, but much more motivated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to point out something too, and I had thought of this during the movie, I forgot it, but I'm glad that we brought up this idea of success and failure, is I recall a conversation between Germans and Americans where the Germans were telling us, you are cowboys, you conquered a continent and built it. That's not a very German attitude. There's a reason that we didn't do a lot in the way of empire. If you're going to start a business or undertake something risky in Germany, everyone's going to kind of cast doubt on you. And then when you fail, you just go back into the fold. Whereas in American culture, this sort of like, I failed once, but I'm going to try again, this dust myself off, get back up, that's very much an American trait. And maybe the reason I don't like the way it's depicted in here is because it's done by Germans who fundamentally don't understand it.
That's a good point, actually. That's actually a really excellent take on that. Because it's a noble thing to dream a grand dream. And I mean, that's ultimately like, that's like our little thing, movement, whatever you want to call it, has been like what like the imagery we've always tried to hearken back to. And it feels like we're like, some of us are coming away from that now, but the imagery we always hearken back to is like, you know, America conquered a continent, America wanted to conquer the stars, despite, I don't want to rustle Johnny's feathers here, but we went to the moon. I mean, this is like, it's a noble thing to dream a grand dream, and it just seems so foreign to us. Like, just, it's foreign to us, this idea of trying to quash someone else's dream and to make fun of that. Mm-hmm. Like, it just rubs us the wrong way. Like, this is like the one thing
we like underdogs. We like, you know, pursuit. It's who we are in our national character. Our country was comprised of all of the people from Europe, Germany in particular, who had the balls to leave.
Yeah. And like, we were like, in respect to like culture, like we were like cultural underdogs, because it's always been very fashionable to shit on America from Europe. And that's not like a post World War II phenomenon, because a lot of people's exposure to it was with the Iraq War stuff and all that. Like, that is not a post World War II phenomenon. That has there used to be a thesis about America called the degeneration thesis, that just like something about the landscape just made European man worse and degenerated them. Like, they had all kinds of theories and the like about this, and that the land, you know, violently repulses people who aren't native to it. And I mean, like, Americans, like the story of us, like in our own, you know, imagination of it, is like, we conquered this land and we came out on top. We were the underdog and we came out on top. That's part of the reason why we love underdog stories of these dreaming big and achieving. So it just feels wrong to us when we see this kind of like, this kind of naysaying. We're Americans, not Americans.
Damn right. Border.
So we're kind of in a transition stage ourselves right now, because like we're living in this declining empire. We don't even like feel like we are who we are anymore, largely because like they're trying to replace the population here and just saying like anybody can be an American. That's
well, it's going to take that same spirit to repel this. We conquered this continent once. We can do it again.
We have to be the
remember your ancestors.
We have to be the natural fauna in this place now.
Yeah.
That repulses the foreigner, basically. But, yeah, I mean, final thoughts on this? I think we're kind of at the end here, unless you guys had any other topics you wanted to bring up.
Sorry. I know what you're about to do.
Yeah, final thoughts on this movie, recommendations?
Decent movie. Again, I thought the lead actor was terrible. I'm going to say this isn't worth 2 hours and 40 minutes of your time.
Schizo?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, what I was saying is that, for example, we were talking about the Reconquista issue, but I believe you don't have to be autistic at this time to do the Reconquista, because we are all being attacked by this global empire that is at its core is sadly in your country. It is in Wall Street banking and in Washington, D.C. capital. But I believe we can do this together. Not autistically together, like diversity is our strength. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about we all have our own struggles, but always let's try to find connected tissue, just like Fitzcarraldo did. He thought that the natives wanted to listen to music, and that wasn't the case. But he found a connected tissue with them, and they make a joint venture project that actually succeeded, and he was able to be remembered in history because of this. I believe this is the new future. It is always possible to do this. That's why I don't look that much to my ancestors, because they already have done what they needed to do. I will need to do what I feel that I can do, even if I am wrong, even if there are failures during the time span that I am trying to do this, to do this stuff. But I believe there are different issues that I am going to do very differently than my ancestors did, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would recommend this movie. It's not the greatest movie, but it's as a technical piece. I mean, like just you get to see them drag an actual boat over a mountain. Like if that like I. I'm in it for the spectacle at this point, but but it also like it resonates with me because of its its themes of failure and dreaming your dream kind of thing. So I just recommend it on that level. It's a good movie. Herzog is great. So all I got to really say on that's all I really got to say on that. So I guess with that, I'm gonna push the pause button on this.